Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the next session, which is a panel discussion on regulation, risk and privacy, data security, the EU General Data Protection Regulation and the Global Connected Enterprise. And I'm going to hand straight over to our moderator for the panel, who is Stuart Room, who's a partner with PwC. So straight over to you, Stuart.
Thanks, Vicky. So you obviously are really interested in the GDPR. As well as the other potpourri of subjects. But before I introduce our panelists or ask them to introduce themselves, I just want to get a sense of scale. I think we can start off with scale. So how big is the GDPR? So I want you to try and think about the biggest piece of law that you can be aware of. So let's think about employment law. How many cases end up in the employment tribunals? How many people exit work and then start to raise employment complaints? Millions and millions of issues around Europe each year. But let's think about health and safety. How many times do people sue because of injuries, whether in the workplace or out on the street? Think about all that yellow and black tape that you see on raggedy carpets in hotels in the workplace. Absolutely massive. Now, the biggest legal things that you can think about are nowhere near as big as the GDPR. This law will regulate every single entity from the biggest multinational player right down to your local window cleaner if they touch personal data. Between there, every school, every charity, every public authority, every sports club, everything. And in terms of beneficiaries, every living individual in Europe and potentially most of the world is a beneficiary. So all you need to do to be regulated is touch information about people, and all you need to do to be a beneficiary is live and breathe. From the moment you're born until the moment you're in the box, you are a beneficiary of this law. Employment law is massive, but it doesn't mean a jot if you're not working or you're not employing anyone. Health and safety law is massive, but it doesn't mean a thing if there's no issues on the ground. This exists in every workplace, and it affects all of us. So that's the framework in which we're going to talk today. Before we get into that, I want my panelists to introduce themselves and tell you about themselves and whom they work for and what they do.
Hi, I'm Quentin Taylor, and after that particular introduction, I'm now starting to wonder... No. Absolutely right. So I'm Quentin Taylor. I look after information security at Canon EMEA, and I also co-chair the Data Protection Competence Centre.
Yeah, hi everyone. It's great to see such a huge audience for a data protection event. I'm Ian Bourne from the Information Commissioner's Office. We're the regulator for data protection and freedom of information law in the UK. I've worked a lot on the GDPR during the last 4 years. I guess I've been our sort of policy lead in the office. But I've also done work on anonymization, privacy notices, data sharing in the past, all of which kind of comes together in the melange, which is the GDPR.
Hi, I'm Nina Baraxay. I'm Group Head of Privacy for Sky, and I handle all of the privacy issues. We're a commercial organisation, but we also have broadcasting, so I have public interest issues there as well.
And good morning, everybody. I'm Eduardo Ustran. I'm a partner at Hogan Lovells, based here in London, and I lead the European team of our global privacy and cybersecurity practice. We're a team of specialist lawyers advising on the whole range of issues that you would be facing in relation to the General Data Protection Regulation. And it's a pleasure to be here with all of you today.
Fantastic. So you've got some real leading lights here today. If you've got any burning questions, put your hands up and we'll try to take them. So I've really bigged up the GDPR, but actually it doesn't matter because we're going to Brexit in a couple of weeks' time and the GDPR is a dead story. So it's over before we begin. Eduardo, what's your view on that?
So my very simple view is that Brexit will not happen in the data protection world. And I wrote an opinion piece about this a few weeks ago. And the position is very simple. Brexit, we don't know, let's say it's 50-50 chances. If it happens, if we as voters choose to leave the European Union, the UK is going to have to make a decision. Not us as the voters, but the government. Should we go along on data protection law, or should we follow Europe? I can guarantee with 100% certainty, and I can explain the details, that the UK government will follow European data protection law, no matter what. Because it's the only way for the UK to continue to be part of the digital economy in a lawful way. And for that reason alone, the UK will not Brexit European data protection law. That's
so,
my view.
Eduardo, you may say that, but let's ask the regulator, because of course, us lawyers, we can really talk up this story. Ian, you're going to be regulating whether we have Brexit or not. Is the Information Commissioner's Office going to regulate to GDPR standards regardless of the outcome? What do you think?
Well, it depends on how you do Brexit, and there are forms of data protection law that are much more attractive than the GDPR internationally. And I think we need to remember that there are many countries all over the world, in Australia, in Indonesia, in New Zealand, all sorts of places, Canada, where there is a fully functioning form of privacy law, and in many cases the European Union and the European Commission have deemed that to be adequate and to provide a satisfactory level of protection. So there actually are quite a lot of options, I think. I don't think it's quite as straightforward that we're necessarily going to have absolutely 100% GDPR, whatever happens during Brexit. So I think there are a number of possibilities. It also depends on how you do Brexit, what the kind of political complexion is. But there will be some form of information rights law, I'm sure, just as there is in any other developed economy. I think that's become a reality of life.
Okay, let's look at this from a business perspective. So let's ignore the lawyers, let's ignore the regulators, let's actually speak to the people who really matter. So Quentin, you are in a multinational business, you've got to play on the global stage. What will your entity do about data protection if there is Brexit? Will you work to GDPR in any event?
I think we'll absolutely have to, because we've got data centers all over Europe, we've got data transfers that happen across huge numbers of countries, and at the moment we just accept that as part of doing business. And if we do exit and we then have to have a separate regulatory framework here, it'll have huge impacts for anyone who's a multinational. And I think also it'll have huge impacts to British businesses. And me talking more personally here, imagine if you are a financier in Hamburg or in Frankfurt, are you really going to say, I'm okay to have my data transferring via the UK? You're going to say, no, I want some kind of safe harbor some kind of privacy shield like mechanics in place to protect that data, and you really are going to start to demand proper protections, and then you might start ending up with stuff going to the European court, like we saw with the Schrems case, based with the UK in the dock rather than the Americans in the dock.
So Nina, how about you? What's Sky's position? Do you see as a business person, whether at Sky or just as a business person, the same position that Quentin's painting here?
Yes, I think so. I think part of the challenge for us is we are operating in multiple territories across various activities, and so we need to have free flow of data across all of our boundaries so that we can carry on doing our business and, for example, get news to people, make sure we have our employees paid, and all of those things need to be done lawfully. Our customers need to be serviced. Why would we not do it lawfully? If we want to do it lawfully, it doesn't really matter whether Brexit is going to happen or not. We have to make sure we comply with our laws and those laws of those countries where we have employees and engagement. So I don't think there would be any difference for us. We have to do things the right way, and that would be the starting point. I think picking up Ian's point, we would want to see there's some flexibility. And if we can do something that's practical and pragmatic and still lets us do business, picking up Quentin's point, then we'll try that route. The worry for us is that there's so much uncertainty, we can't get it done quickly.
Okay, so there's the first takeaway, guys. Regardless of how you vote on the 23rd, you're still doing GDPR. So great news. Can I just take the safe harbour conversation forward? Quentin, you've already brought it in, but Eduardo, in the safe harbour case, what we had was Europe effectively bringing America into the European privacy line. Is that what happened in that case?
So, as you probably know, the export of data, and by the way, data is every single interaction we have with technology today. So the export of that information outside the European Union is effectively prohibited unless there is an adequate level of protection that is European data protection at the other end. The US doesn't have that. The safe harbor was an attempt to have that, and the court eliminated that possibility simply because, according to the court, the US legal framework does not provide enough protection for data being accessed by government authorities and public authorities. And for that reason alone, no matter how many protections you think you have, no matter how safe your cloud is, the US government still has access to that data, according to European courts, and therefore, for that reason, the US, until a change in the law is achieved, will continue to be unsafe. And that is the uncertainty we are facing.
And there's a privacy shield thing, isn't there, that's replaced safe harbor. So Nina, the US has signed up for a privacy shield. That's in dispute. We know that. But is this really telling us that the world has to dance to the European privacy tune?
No, I think I don't take it from that angle at all. I start with, how do I want to make sure I look after the data that we are responsible for? Everything else then flows from that. Who does it, how they do it, and where it is really becomes secondary. There is a legal framework, yes, Eduardo has explained that, but that isn't the only basis on which you will pass data back and forth. If you've got a particular reason to pass data, you'll want to make sure that where you're passing it, how you're passing it, who you're giving it to is safe. And that really is your standard, so set your standard first. The law will be there, but it's the underlying framework rather than the overarching framework.
So people still need to have benchmarks to aim at.
Yeah.
They need something on a page that makes sense. So Ian, can I take the question to you? So from a regulator's perspective, mm-hmm. do we think that the GDPR is the best privacy law around? What do you think?
I don't think it matters whether it's the best anymore. It's been voted on, it's been accepted, and we've got it, and we're going to make it work as best we can. There are some very clunky bits in it. There are some very over-the-top bits. There are some very unclear bits of drafting. There are some features that are a very dubious benefit, I think, to individuals. For example, going back to what we were just talking about, having to explain to the public about international transfer rules and data protection, the adequacy of particular nations that you transfer data to, I think most consumers won't understand that or really care about it, to be frank. So it's there, we'll make it work, we'll work within the ICO, we'll work with other European data protection authorities to try and make it work as well as we can and have reasonable, sensible outcomes and a sense of proportionality in terms of how we scale this, because if we get it wrong, it could lead to some very, very difficult compliance tasks for some very, very low-risk organisations, which I think we all want to avoid.
So are you effectively saying, Ian, that there are two privacy worlds? That there's a privacy world in legislation, such as the GDPR, and then there's a privacy world that you work in and live in, which is a network of cooperation between regulators and people who enforce the law. Is that really the message that the crowd should take?
Yeah, there is that, and there's a whole parallel world of data protection, I think. There's all the compliance stuff and dotting the I's and crossing the T's and doing all the stuff that the big list of GDPR tasks gives you. But that doesn't stop you doing things in a much more imaginative, better way. A good example is the privacy notices stuff, where under the GDPR, you're going to have to tell people a whole big, long list of stuff which most people won't understand, and it also has to be concise at the same time, which is interesting. But that doesn't mean that you can't do just-in-time notices, you can't do pop-ups, you can't do more engaging, yes, I agree to this type approaches, which are much more appealing from a consumer point of view, much more engaging. So I think we've got to kind of do the compliance stuff on the one hand, but forge ahead and do all the really clever, wonderful things that the technology allows us to do on the other, and square the two as best we can. But I think that's what enlightened companies are doing, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about enlightened companies, Quentin. So I know Canon, you've done a stack of work on this. I mean, how are you finding your way between, you know, the legislative stuff that is quite prescriptive and this other world of privacy that isn't accessible? You know, we don't really understand it. We can't pull it off the shelves and download it. It's the world where Ian lives. How are you charting the path?
Well, to split that up very, very quickly, we take it as in privacy and data protection are two very slightly different pieces. You've got the data protection piece, which is the law and the regulation. You've got privacy, which is what our customers expect us to do. And at the end of the day, we always intend to actually, under KSA principles, which is one of our guiding principles, to actually treat that data with respect and treat it in the way that the users want it to be treated. But first of all, I think the main thing is to have an initial strategy of what you're trying to do. Now, that pretty much, I just said, is kind of the function of our initial part of our strategy. But if you don't have that, then it's going to be a very, very hard world to navigate until you hit May the 25th, 2018.
So there's something interesting in there. Are you saying, Quentin, that, you know, almost that there's kind of an ethical position here that businesses can get to, whether you call them guiding principles or whatever it might be, vision around data protection. And if an entity gets that right, that should carry them through the complexity of compliance and regulation. Is that there for you?
Well, ask me in 2 years and I'll tell you whether that is the case. However, that is what I'm sincerely hoping. I think if you do the right thing and you try and do the right thing, whilst keeping a good eye on what's going on the legal side, I'm hoping that you actually can get through in a very, very easy way, and also with your customers still respecting you for what you've tried to achieve.
Nina, is that where Sky is? There is a right thing to do,
yeah.
And that will coincide with the law and the requirements of regulators.
It sounds really kind of trite following straight on from Quentin, but we already started that probably in ages ago, but we had data governance. We don't do compliance, we do assurance. And we have what I would call a framework of all of those ethical reasons, the business purposes, the conceptual guidance, so that people have a kind of a starting point, some principles, how we're doing stuff, why we're doing it, what we're doing it for, who we're doing it with, so that we are comfortable as an organization, that we have consistency, and we have managing directors sitting around a table discussing how they'll use data across jurisdictions to make sure that it's consistent, so it's not something surprising, unexpected, that the consumers who we're dealing with their data, it's not our data, we don't own it, we're just held responsible and we're entrusted with it, the kind of Asia-Pacific type of language. We're doing that discussion, that thinking, on a daily, weekly basis. All of our project teams have that embedded. All of our operations have that embedded. So we've already been thinking about this for many years and doing it because it's easier for us.
So there's this doing the right thing that will get us through the complexities in a global environment. Eduardo, let me bring you in. So you and I worked together in the same firm for years and years and years. We know that wasn't the story just 5 years ago. I mean, clients were not talking about data protection as a do the right thing. It was about compliance and regulation, wasn't it? I mean, what are we seeing? You know, so as we're serving entities, what are we seeing? Are they saying that it's about doing the right thing now?
Well, it's about doing the right thing in a sense. You can always look at compliance as doing the right thing. What makes a difference is what is the motivation for doing the right thing? Is the motivation for doing the right thing that is good for your business, for example? So having the right privacy policies or agreements with vendors, is that right? Is the right thing to do because it's good to protect your business and indirectly the trust of your customers? Or is the motivation the fact that there is a huge risk behind not doing the right thing? And I think if there is one area in which the GDPR is going to make a big difference is perhaps not so much the principles and the ethics and the philosophy behind European data protection law. That hasn't changed. Perhaps it should have been reformed, but it hasn't changed. What changes is the level of risk of non-compliance, because we have out there some very aggressive regulators, and you can have a scale of how aggressive you are, and maybe you put the ICO in a sort of relatively manageable scale, end of the scale. But I see the fuller picture. I work across the world, across Europe, and in Europe, in continental Europe, we are part of Europe, of course. On continental Europe, you have regulators out there that acting as privacy activists. And when you give a regulator that is acting as a privacy activist the power to enforce the law and to impose fines of millions of euros, and which are measured based on the turnover of your organization, then, my friends, the level of risk for non-compliance rockets.
In actual fact, we saw a few days ago out of Hamburg, the data protection regulator, obviously in Germany they have don't just have one, they have, is it 17 plus one over the top, they actually issued fines for non-compliance with safe harbor legislation. People hadn't moved across to Privacy Shield or to model clauses, and so whilst the fines were relatively small, they were in the tens of thousands of euros, I imagine the regulatory overhead of suddenly having to get their houses in order for these four companies that were fined was probably quite significant.
Okay, I want to move this forward now. So we've looked at the idea that We've got a thing that we have to deal with regardless of Brexit. We've got the idea that doing the right thing is the right way forward. But let's now actually get into the weeds of the GDPR. So what I want to ask all of you, taking a turn, I'm going to let you go first, is just to name one of the innovations in the GDPR. And there's lots and lots of new things coming down the pipe. And if you can just tell the audience just what that is to you. So do you want to go first,
sure.
An innovation?
I do appreciate this gets harder the further you go down. But the one for me, I'd say, thank you, let me go first, would be, I'd say Article 77, which is joint liabilities for processors and controllers. If you do a lot of work with respect to where you are a processor and not a controller, this should make your contracting, in theory, a lot easier.
So this is hitting at vendor risk management, joint liability. So we've got innovation there. Nina, can I ask you next?
So I think that the thing that we're most keen and enthusiastic about, if it works, is main establishment, which gives us one place to talk to a regulator about stuff that we need to discuss across our group. It will make it easier. It'll be swifter. We can do business quicker. They will understand our business. We can build a relationship. The challenge, if it doesn't work, and we do have multiple versions, it's going to be much harder.
And Ian, what about you? Can you give me some innovations?
Okay, I'll give you two. A new right, data portability, which, as you'll know, under current law, you have a right of subject access, which allows you to get a copy of information about you. Data portability is a bit of an enhanced version of that, where you can get the information in a readily transferable, easily machine-readable way, so you can get your data taken from one electricity company and given to another automatically and free. And I think that could be a great consumer benefit. The other thing I'd mention as a kind of innovation is a bit of a technical issue about scope and about what is personal data and what does the law apply to. And I think the regulation is quite good in that it's made it clearer that there's a very, very wide spectrum of identifiers, lots of different ways of identifying people, and that when we do things like take people's IP addresses, take identification code numbers for phones and other types of equipment, and we analyze that data, we're actually processing information about the person who owns the phone, not about the phone. And I think this puts to bed a really kind of silly argument we've had from the technology industry for many years that, no, we're not really tracking people, we're tracking just phones, which has got very hollow a long time ago. But I think putting that one to bed is very, very useful.
And how about you, Eduardo?
So I think for me, the key innovation is a very crucial one for two reasons. One, because it reflects the new spirit of the law focusing on the practicality of data protection rather than the paperwork. And the other reason is because it does that in a positive way. So it looks at what can be gained from good data protection practices. And this innovation is data protection by design. It's going to affect all of you. It's going to affect all of us. It's a new law. It's a new provision in the law. It doesn't exist. There is no framework in the world, as far as I have seen, that has this in the black letter of the law, where in order to implement any new system, develop, whether it is an app or a new database or a new loss prevention system, whatever you're going to do technologically, has to go through this filter of the data protection by design, which means that at the time of design and implementation, you need to go through the privacy principles and say, how do we deal with this? How do we meet this requirement? How safe is this? How transparent is this? Are we taking more data than we need? And you just go through that checklist before or at the time that this is implemented. This is a key new obligation that we are all going to have to learn to play with.
Mm. Okay, so can I just tie this together? Because I'll show you where I'm going with this and why I want you to do that. So we've got much more expansive scope. That's what you were saying. More stuff is regulated.
It's clearer what is
expansive
regulated.
And clearer.
Yeah.
So more's covered. Then we've got a new kind of way of regulating, a one-stop shop. You were talking about that. And you were telling me about liability issues. Mm. That's changed. And Eduardo, you were pointing to new compliance obligations. Right? And there's lots more, isn't there? We've got privacy impact assessments, we've got breach disclosure, we've got data protection officers and things like that. Where I'm heading with this is it seems like there is a lot to do under this regime, and there potentially isn't enough time to do it. This is where I'm going. So what about prioritization? Are we now at the time when all of the entities here should go back and say, we've got to start prioritising. You know, we've got to start picking the battles and getting them right. So Nina, I'll look to you first. What about this idea? Is prioritisation important for our people?
So we know that there are plenty of things to do. We know that if we're working with systems, it's going to take quite a long time. So what we're doing is working backwards from May 18. What do we need to do by May 18, and how do we then start? What takes time? What's quick? So if you've got a privacy notice and you need to tell all of your customers, how long will it take? If you've got a system and you've got to change the functionality, that will not take 3 minutes. So we're looking at things that need to take a length of time to do, and then starting to plan those. And we're doing that to make sure that we've got all of our agile teams in place, we've got all of the principles in place, so that we can start designing, as Eduardo says, design up front, because we will then need to design, develop, implement, and then test. Because otherwise we're going to get to May 18 and it won't work, and we're automatically in exposed positions.
So effectively, Nina, what you've got there is a sense of there is a deliberate program here,
yep,
to get you where,
yes,
you feel you need to be.
Yeah, we have a two-year program, yep, across all jurisdictions.
Okay. Can I take you in a different way, Quentin? What about themes and subject matter? You know, is there within this themes that are more important than others, so we would prioritise them? So, for instance, is breach disclosure much, much more important than a different theme?
No. I mean, if I look at these things and you look at, like, the 14 major pieces, yes, it's very easy to get lost and get focused on the 2 or 4% of global turnover. But in actual fact, things like having to document all of your processes, that's a major thing, especially if the processes are all slightly different in different countries. Mm. The privacy by design that was just mentioned, actually, from an information security perspective, that's beautiful, that's brilliant. Because suddenly, from an information security perspective, that gives you a seat at the table. Fine, it gives you a seat at the table in part of the privacy impact assessment, privacy by design discussion, but you could chuck a security conversation there as well. So none of this, oh, we get involved too late. Now, if you get your privacy hat on, you can get involved right at the beginning, and there's a legally mandated reason for being there. So I think of all the different bits and pieces, not all of them the most important. Some of them are going to be an awful lot more work, and I like your idea saying, start working backwards and say, how long does each thing take, and work out how much time we've got to do those things.
Well, let me bring in the regulator then. So, Ian, there is a sense, however, that people won't get to do everything over the next, mm-hmm, 2 years. Are you going to cut people slack? Are you going to give them credit for trying? You know, where's the regulator going to be on this?
Yeah, there will be an element of that. And if people are failing to do really important things that has a real impact on people, then yeah, of course, we'll go for those people. If it's a more kind of technical paperwork failure, then of course, we're not going to go looking for that unless it's part of a wider kind of systemic problem that an organisation has got. So there will be some cutting of slack, but you've got a lot to do in 2 years. Things like bringing in a system for breach notification is going to actually be quite difficult for a big organisation. And for our own part, we've put out a 12-step guide, which is some things that you should be doing now in terms of things like raising corporate awareness, because your bosses probably have this kind of unspecified dread about all this, but don't really know what they have to do. So there are things like that, and things like the repapering you're going to have to do in terms of different privacy notices, different contracts with data processes, and so forth. So we've done this 12-step thing, which is on a microsite we've done on the GDPR, which is dpreform.org.uk. And at the end of June, we'll be putting out a more substantive guide to the GDPR, which is based on the main differences between current law and the GDPR and things that you should be doing now. And it will be clear and accessible and practical, and hopefully that will be useful. But you are going to have your work cut out, I think. And again, this might sound trite, but organisations that are good at data protection now, that do things well, that have proper privacy notices, that collect information properly, will not have as much to do as bad organisations who don't do those things.
Okay, I want to run with this idea now about the regulators cutting us a bit of slack, because that will give some comfort to organisations. It's a good bit of mood music.
Yeah.
But the thing is, Ian, you're not the only regulator, and I don't mean there's other statutory regulators. We know there's 28 regulators across Europe. I'm talking about the different kinds of regulators. I'm talking about the citizen, and I'm talking about the judges. You know, they're regulators as well, aren't they? And what we've seen over recent years is the emergence to supremacy, almost, of the citizen and the judges in the regulatory space. So that's the proposition. Eduardo, can you just expand on that in the context of SREMs in the context of Digital Rights Ireland, pressure groups, and also where the judiciary has been over recent years, right to be forgotten, things like that.
So, yeah, I think maybe in Europe we're used to this culture where we don't, as individuals, our instinct is not to take things to court. If we have an issue, we go to the regulator, we rely on the regulator. It's a very European way of thinking. And the law has, until now, has been engineered in such a way that that was the sort of the way in which enforcement was facilitated. One of the many changes that GDPR brings is the ability for the citizen, and not just the citizen, but consumer organizations and industry bodies and privacy activists to take companies, organizations to court much more easily and request changes in data practices and ask the courts to enforce the law before regulators. And that at the time, precisely at a time when what we have seen, and of course, Stuart, you see that all the time, courts are also behaving in a way that they are trying to influence the outcomes with a privacy activist hat on. And if you look at the Supreme Court in Europe in terms of data protection issues, the European Court of Justice, and if you look at every single decision of the past 2 years involving data protection, whether it was the Data Retention Directive, whether it was the Google Spain case, whether it was the Max Rem decision, in every single one of them, 100% outcome has been strongly in favor of the individual and strongly going even beyond sometimes what the claimant was trying to achieve, going beyond that and saying, this is wrong, this needs to be put right. So that is something that we need to, I'm not trying to scare people off, I'm just trying to actually describe the situation in which we are so that when we look at compliance, when we look at the risk management and et cetera and priorities and so on, we take that into account.
I think it's important also, Stuart, that we're talking about the GDPR, but there are other regulations which protect consumers. And what we find as an organization is that a lot of those regulations intersect with privacy. So there's Consumer Rights Directive, there's a Digital Single Market, there's the E-Privacy Directive. All of these things are interconnecting. We are, as a telco as well, subject to telco regulation. So each instance of that regulation will intersect with privacy regs, and we have to be able to navigate a way through it, really, as Quentin describes, to get us to our business activity, but equally to do things that that people who are giving us their data expect us to do. The worst thing is to do something that is completely unusual and out of sync with what people expect. And so for us as a business, what we're trying to do is deliver that level of certainty and assurance, but still get our business done. And that's the balance.
No, but so Quentin, let me bring you in then. So what we're really seeing here then is a new risk in the data protection environment, these additional regulators. So for you as an entity, how are you modelling that risk? How are you coping with it? You know, are there things that we need to do that we've not done in data protection before? So just learn to say sorry.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, very clear that in reality, we talk about the citizen regulators, is you've got to listen to these people now. And even companies in the past weren't. They've now got to say, actually, what is it that people who are entrusting their data to me are expecting me to do with their data? And I think things like breach notification will be a wonderful opportunity for companies to actually say sorry to consumers when inevitably certain things do go wrong.
I was going to say, we're already subject to breach notification obligations as a telco. And I think there's a balance. Sometimes those breach notification obligations are quite narrow, and so you find that you're notifying for things that really don't have a massive impact on an individual. Even if they do, you will have addressed it because you're doing that. But there's fatigue in that you can notify for many things that really aren't as significant as perhaps the regulation was expecting to get. And so there's a balance between, yes, you will always notify the things that are a problem, but equally, the regulation is so tightly worded that you don't have a choice. And so there's a flood of everyday, low-level notifications for somebody's got their email wrong. And yes, it's important to both of those two individuals, but at the end of the day, the regulator is now flooded with those kinds of things. Now, we're lucky we have a great regulator to do those kinds of things and work with us, but I'm not sure that all of the other regulators around the EEA are like that.
Ian, can I just test this idea out about breach notification? Because there is a natural worry that transparency gives the oxygen to further further problems. So the more people know about things, the greater is the risk that they may sue about them, for instance.
Absolutely.
But if we look at the telco example that Nina's referred to about breach disclosure, we've had that in since about 2010, roughly, or was it 2012? I can't remember, but it's been on the in effect for a number of years now. I mean, that regime hasn't actually delivered any regulatory action, really, has it? As at least observable.
No, it's done quite a lot of behind-the-scenes good practice improvement type stuff, and we're quite good at analysing this stuff and looking at patterns. So, it has actually worked quite well. But we are worried about over-notification, because if you don't notify when you're supposed to, of course, you could get a very big fine. And the way the GDPR is worded, and this is typically the GDPR, is that it's not very clear in terms of when you have to notify and when you don't. It talks about risk to individuals' fundamental rights and freedoms, which, like, what does that mean, you know? Which is why I think data protection authorities, including the ICO, have got a real job to do in terms of breaking that down into some real-world concepts like harm, loss, embarrassment, something like that, which is what we're trying to do through the Article 29 subgroup at the moment, which is the group of European data protection regulators, actually including or the participation of some non-EU countries, which is probably something for the to look for in the future.
But we saw the danger of under-notification just recently with a certain social media site that in 2012 had 5 million or admitted 5 million accounts were compromised, and it turned out to be 171. Mm. And this week we're seeing both malware that's punching out into Benelux yesterday. We saw the social media accounts of a very senior social media CEO also being compromised potentially as a result of that. So I think we can have it both ways. If we over-regulate or over-notify, then we have breach notification or say breach fatigue. But also, we can now see the danger of under-notifying.
Yeah, but I think, sorry, I was going to say, part of the benefit we've found, and it is a load, but it's also a benefit, because we know we have to notify, and we've got to do it within 24 hours. The regulations say 72 for everyone, but we've got to do it in 24. We have controls in place that catch things, that spot things. Our cybersecurity folks, our information security folks, are watching all of this stuff for us. And that's great because we can notify, but equally, it gives them full visibility across many areas of the company that trigger other activities. So it's a real positive with a compliance underlying piece of it, but commercially, it then gives us that access to do things really quickly. So as an organization, we can move faster because we've got a control framework in place. So I do think there are balances. I don't think we should say it's a load. Yes, it is, but it gives all of those commercial benefits as well because we are now structured to allow us to do that.
Eduardo, I know you wanted to jump in.
I think that is precisely the purpose. Mm. That's the idea. But I think what is really, really important to appreciate is that this is a significant change from the point of view of the visibility that our vulnerability is going to have. I'm sure many of you, like many of us, have been involved at one point or another in some kind of data incident. Something has happened. What do we do now? One of the questions lawyers are always asked is, do we need to notify anybody? Do we need to notify the ICO? At the moment, there is a high degree of discretion. And I would guess that out of 10 data incidents that any of us has to deal with, I would say not more than one or two are actually notified. So it is that very, very low percentage. That discretion is going to be significant. It's not going to go entirely. There's still an element of discretion in terms of assessing the risk, but it's going to be reduced quite significantly. So if out of 10 breaches, you are notifying one, and in 2 years' time, out of 10 breaches, you're going to have to notify six, how does that change?
Well, let's just think about the effect that's going to have in terms of the psychology of data protection. So in 24 months' time, we're going to have a much more rigorous notification regime applying to everyone in comparison to the one that currently applies to telcos.
Yeah.
I mean, this is going to be a massive shock, isn't it? We're going to see in May, June, July next year, hysteria in the newspapers just about the extent of insecurity that is going to surface in the UK due to this. And that's going to cascade people into privacy panic. Have we got that risk coming forward in the economy, Quentin?
I think it's going to. I saw some state stats last night saying that current spending in InfoSec is 70 billion, and by 2020 it'll be 170 billion. I don't think those stats took into place the panic around GDPR when we start hitting May the 25th, 2018. I think the spending is going to go up dramatically. But I think also it's going to be, we're going to see a lot of other areas which are going to benefit. So I think InfoSec, which is the reason why it's here, is going to benefit tremendously from this legislation.
Well, how about, what do you think, Ian? Yeah. Say we're going to lift the lid on a problem that we only are scratching the surface at. Are we going to see shock in the minds of people?
I think you might be quite surprised at the scale of breaches that are actually occurring. The other thing is, to remember about the GDPR, is you don't just have to tell the regulator. In some cases, you have to actually tell the members of the public. So that will open the way for class actions and all sorts of other kinds of things that are going to happen. I think, generally speaking, you're going to see a lot more kind of information consumer activism. It's very similar to what you see in Holland and Germany. I think we're going to see a lot more of that, which actually can have very good effects. And I think it's important to remember that a lot of changes that have happened in things like social media companies haven't happened because of regulators or judges. They've happened because groups of Facebook users have banded together and said, we don't like this, change it. I think you're going to see way more of that, which is a really good, healthy thing, I think. Mm.
So, Ian, can I just carry on with you and then expand it out? So, I just want to do an analogy. So, in 2005, the Freedom of Information Act came in.
Yeah.
And we had a two-year run-up where public authorities had to publish their publication schemes about what they put in the domain.
Yeah.
And what we know happened, because society had a two-year run at it, two-year preparation time, is that on the 1st of January, or whatever was the first working day, you know, after the new year, the letterboxes were rammed full of FOI requests in public authorities. They were coming in by the sack load. Are we going to see this in the economy, where entities that are data profiling, entities that are monetizing data, they're going to get sackfuls of letters in 24 months' time because privacy advocates are ready and preparing? I mean, what's your sense of that?
No, I don't think so. And I think FOI was different. I remember, to my personal pain, some of the early FOI requests and how difficult they were. But no, I mean, the FOI was brand new. That was a different thing. There were access codes before that. But most things that you can actually do now as a member of the public, in terms of complaining, finding things out, you can actually do already. The GDPR doesn't actually give you that much that's new, so I don't think it's going to be a kind of a year zero torrent of complaints and issues. I think it'll be a different, more gentle kind of thing.
And you published a blog a few days ago where the Information Commissioner's Office said that subject access requests were approximately 50% of all complaints you were dealing with.
Yeah, and that's going to go up because subject access is going to be free. We quite like a £10 sensible deterrent fee, and you will get more people making more requests, including a lot of vexatious ones, but we'll be reasonable in terms of saying, no, you can tell that person to go away if it's the 30th request that year or whatever it is. But you're going the subject access thing, I think, is going to be a really significant change. And I think there are lots of us who have probably thought, what's my employer got on me, or my ex-employer, or somebody I've dealt with who thought, well, I can't be bothered. When it's easier, free, and faster, I think a lot of people will find that very attractive. Mm-hmm. And I think that in turn will lead to a whole load of additional complaints, because you'll have records that are inaccurate, you'll have records that people think are inaccurate but aren't, you'll have every form of dispute you can imagine, which we see all the time at the ICA, and we're dealing with like 15,000 of these a year now. Subject access type complaints, so that's going to be a huge issue for you, I think.
Okay, we're coming into the final stretch of this, so what I want to get into is some of the themes in a global connected environment and practical tips about how we can deal with them. So if we think about vendor risk management and the cloud, so we've got a huge amount of GDPR change there. So what are we going to do, Nina? Any tips for the people here about how we manage these risks?
I think start with your standards, make sure they do what you want them to do, and then try and work with partners who are agreeing with that and comfortable with that. But in a sense, picking up Ian's point, we want to make things practical. We don't want to do things that are not going to work for business. So get to your starting point and agree that starting point, and then move forward. It's so the quickest way.
Clarity over standards, that's going to be helpful in the cloud.
And Eduardo, partners.
And partners. Eduardo, can I bring you in terms of contracting? Are we going to see changes in legal contracting for the GDPR dealing with cloud and the vendor issues?
Yeah, the GDPR is very prescriptive in terms of what you need to have in contract with any vendor. So, again, I can guarantee you already that not a single contract already in place today with a vendor, with a data vendor, there are loads of vendors here today, not a single one that is currently in place will be compliant. Not because they are rubbish contracts, it's because they are contracts that are not addressing the obligations that are coming. So to review and revise those contracts with vendors, and again, it's a matter of prioritization, which ones are the important ones, which ones are the riskier ones, which ones are more relevant to our business. Look at those contracts, make sure, cross-refer them with the right articles of the law and make sure they say the right things. Because if they don't say the right things, it's a slam dunk for a regulator to say, oh, you got the wrong contract here.
So we've got two ideas. So we've got the standards idea, we've got the new contracting mechanisms. Quentin, can bring you in. But in a more operational sense, how are we going to start dealing with the requirement to gain confidence that the service provider is operationally sound on the ground?
Well, actually, just coming back from one more step before that is actually understanding which contracts you actually have. Understanding which cloud contracts you've got and which data's going where, which obviously be part of your Article 28 obligations, I think will be a very practical thing that a lot of InfoSec people are going to get very heavily involved in. And it's all good to say about the contracts and making sure they're all there, and I fully agree with you, but it's actually knowing which vendors do I need to talk to, I think will be step number one. Which cloud providers am I actually using? And a lot of people, that is not an easy question to ask.
Well, let's assume we get past that. I know it's going to be difficult. And then we're going to start looking at this in an operational sense. What kind of operational comfort are we going to be looking for in order to get the GDPR where it needs to be?
I think from the cloud provider's perspective, I think there'll be ones who take it seriously and the ones actually to understand what customers want, and there'll be ones that won't. And the ones that take it seriously and understand what customers want will be very easy to deal with and be a pleasure to deal with, and the ones that won't and the ones that will fight it, and you know which ones they are because they fight you today on every single contractual clause, they're the ones I suspect are going to start to slip by the wayside. So in this particular respect, the GDPR with its massive hammer of God fines are going to suddenly make that it's going to be non-competitive to not be compliant and not be helping your customers be compliant.
Ian, can I bring you in? What about that scenario where you've got the power in the service provider? So you've got the entity which is much, much, much bigger than the enterprise customer. How should they be approaching their relationships with the Titan so as to get to a level of GDPR comfort?
Yeah. This is very much a legal question, isn't it, about getting the small print right. But I will say something that's actually quite good about the GDPR. If you're an organisation that uses another organisation, for example, to store your information in the cloud, currently, if that organisation, the cloud provider, makes a real mess of things, or they steal the data, or they corrupt it, there's nothing we can do. We can only either go for the data controller, which is the organisation that employs the service, or we can do nothing. But under the GDPR, we will be able to actually go for the data processor. So if you're a really good data controller and you do your due diligence, you have your contracts in place, you inspect the security and do all the things you're required to do, and then your contractor messes up, then we can go for the contract, and which is a much more fair outcome, I think, than under the current law.
Okay, so I want to think about if anyone has got any questions, because we're in our last 10 minutes. So if anyone has, get your arm in the air and we can bring you in. Can't see anything at the moment, so we'll come back and have a look again in a second. So guys, can I take you now into the sanctions regime? So Eduardo, can you just give me a high-level view of the nature of the financial penalty power and what that looks like, please?
So there are two tiers of penalties for different types of breaches, the less serious and the more serious. The less serious breaches, the penalty is an amount of 10 million, maximum of either 10 million euro or I think it's 0.5% of
2%.
The...
2%. 2% of the global turnover of the organization. At the higher end, or the second tier, for the more important obligations, like breaching the rights of individuals or getting international data transfers wrong, that kind of thing, is 20 million euros, or 4% of the global turnover of the organization, whichever is higher. So we're talking of serious money.
Ian, just in comparison now with the Information Commissioner's Office, your maximum fine, half a mil?
Yeah, half a million. And the biggest fine we've done, which we did a few weeks ago, was 450,000 to a company that was making millions and millions of illegal marketing phone calls, and we issued a £450,000 fine. We've got an interesting issue with fines, because if, to put very simply, what that company did equaled £450,000 worth of badness, and it happens in 2 years' time under the GDPR, why is that more badness? Why is it still going to be a £450,000 fine issue? In our opinion, logically, it should be the same, shouldn't it? And I think, hopefully, we'll be able to be reasonable in terms of the fines that we impose. I think where things will get tricky is on international cases. We haven't really talked about it today, but the GDPR contains a very complicated and heavy-duty international consistency process. And in short, what that means is that if we deal with an international cross-border issue, say a £100,000 fine, and the Spanish or the French DPA think that's too low or too high, they can challenge our decision. So that could lead ultimately to a vote, and it could lead ultimately to the fine being ratcheted up to the standards that all the DPAs want. So there's a bit of an issue around fining, which is difficult. There's also issues about, it's all in euros, and there are practical issues around currency exchange rates and all that kind of stuff as well, which we'll need thinking through. And corporate lawyers will have, and accountants will have great fun with us, I can assure you.
But you know, you're not suggesting, are you, that we're going to keep, you know, we're going to start still float around, you know, the sub-million pound fine. So this is going to move up into the multiples of millions over time, isn't it?
It might do, but I think actually you're going to probably get a UK version of data protection and the cross-border international version, something like that. There's no reason why we should. I can't think of any issue we've dealt with in my time, which is a very long time at the ICO, that would warrant a £20 million fine. I just not come across that. They got this from competition law and wanted to kind of make it as important as competition law in terms of the penalties. But I just think that's going to be very exceptional.
Eduardo, can I play you in on this? I mean, is there a risk that if the regulators aren't doling out enough pain, that then gives grist to the mill of the privacy advocates who say, well, we will run with the law then because it's failing in regulation?
It's a risk that has already been proven. If you, for example, follow what happened with the case between the Austrian student Max Rehm against Facebook, he complained to the regulator, to the Irish Data Protection Commissioner, and said, look, my data is being transferred from Facebook in Europe to Facebook in the US. I don't think that's right because it can be accessed by the government, and I don't think that's compliant. The commissioner said, well, I'm really sorry, but Facebook is complying with the safe harbor, so that's okay. And it was that individual who said, well, I'm not actually happy with that. I'm going to challenge that. And it's interesting because you were saying earlier about the sackfuls of people who would complain. Well, it takes one person, a 24-year-old student, to go and challenge the decision of a regulator and say, I don't think that's good enough. And that to go all the way to the European Court of Justice in Luxembourg to say, my friend, you, dear student, you are actually right. And the regulator has had to go back and investigate that further. And of course, the outcome is that 2 weeks ago, the same regulator, the Irish commissioner, was saying, actually, not only the safe harbor wasn't good enough, which was already decided by the European Court of Justice, the actual contracts in place that Facebook has, which, by the way, is a contract that everybody has because it's a model contract, we don't think they are good enough now, so let's just let the court decide. So there's a really interesting morale here, if you want, which is if you're a regulator, you are going to be more mindful of being tough, because otherwise the data subject, the individual, will go against you, and it's, I think, humiliating for a regulator to be told by a court you haven't tried hard enough. Mm.
What do you think about that, Ian? The psychology for the regulator will change.
Yeah, I think it's very good, actually, that regulators can be challenged in terms of what we do. It won't make a change. It's there currently, and we'll deal with court decisions as best we can. But some of them have been very, very challenging, I think, and quite oddly argued.
Okay, so we're getting very, very close to time. No questions have come at the moment, so I want to get your final tips then. So in a connected world, a globalized environment, the GDPR, if you're going to give some takeaways to the guys here, what should they take away with them? So Quentin, do you want to go first, preparing for all of this?
Sure, I'm going to steal your one if I may. Go onto his website and go grab his 12-step plan. If you haven't already got it, go get it. It is actually a really, really sensible, measured approach. And if you go through that, I can't guarantee you'll be compliant or not. But do you know what? You'll be an awful lot further informed.
Fantastic. How about you, Nina? What do you say?
I think get your principles right first. Make sure you know what you want to do and why. And then start flowing that through the organization. Because if you don't know what your starting point is, you've got no hope in hell.
Eduardo, what do you think?
See it as an opportunity. We've talked about the negative side, all the massive risk and all that. Give that a silver lining and look at it. We all have some kind of responsibility to do with privacy and data protection. Use this as the way of seeking resource and budget and the management buy-in that you need to support proper data protection, and see this as the opportunity to allow you to do your job better. That's my take.
And how about you, Ian, just to bring it in?
Yeah, touching on a bit of what Nina said, a bit that you said right at the beginning about thinking, what is this for? I think when you see data protection law, you see this complicated technical stuff with its own parallel vocabulary of data processes and binding corporate rules and this kind of stuff. And I think it's very easy to forget what this is all about in terms of ethics that you mentioned earlier. It's about how do you treat the people whose information you're collecting? That's all it's about, really. And I think if you keep that kind of sense of purpose and vision, I think it makes it a lot easier to fit all the technical bits into place.
Fantastic. So I think we've had a good session. I've gained a lot out of it. I hope you guys have. So I just wanted to tie together some of the thoughts that we've had in terms of dealing with the GDPR and privacy risk in a global environment. So we certainly know that this is massive, that this is new. There's a huge amount of scope change. There's new regulatory schemes. There's new compliance obligations. But we have to be practical and focused because there's too much to do in a short space of time. In order to retain rigor and to retain focus, we need a vision, as Quentin was saying. And that vision, if it accords to doing the right thing, is probably going to get you to the right place globally. There are some very, very clear benchmarks that we need to look to. The regulator has given pragmatic guidance, and we know that they will cut us slack if we don't do everything over the next couple of years. There's no need to panic. If we build a program for the GDPR, we can probably get to do the right things in the time that remains. Ultimately, it's a question of prioritization and risk management. We do all of that, and we shouldn't be afraid of the regulator. However, there's volatility in the environment with the new regulators, the citizen and the judges, so we need to watch that space carefully. So thanks ever so much for listening. If you can give our panelists a round of applause, I think you've done an amazing job today, and we hope you've got a lot out of it. Well done, guys. Well done.